Your talk looks great. Maybe finish in around 15 minutes or 20. And then after you do the talk, I'm going to follow up with some questions to maybe have you elaborate a little bit on it.
Okay.
Any questions?
No, that makes sense. I do want to just say one thing, though, that was I had to be deliberately coy the last time we met because we're sort of keeping this under radar, but we should have a manuscript published next week in which we use BTK inhibitors specifically to treat COVID patients. And it looks great. It's really exciting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing.
From the CME Group Research to Practice, this is Oncology Today. I'm medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Dr. Jeff Sharman is a medical oncologist at Willamette Valley Cancer Institute and Research Center in Eugene, Oregon, and medical director of hematology research at the U.S. Oncology Network. And his specific research focus is chronic lymphocytic leukemia, a disease that has been completely redefined by the use of novel agents instead of more traditional chemoimmunotherapy. On a recent CME webinar on CLL, where Jeff was on a distinguished faculty, one of the topics was clinical trials evaluating the use of Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors as a treatment for patients with COVID-19, where much of the morbidity is thought to be secondary to a hyperimmune response, including cytokine release, that could in theory be blocked by BTK inhibitors. I met with Dr. Sharman by Zoom to work on an education program we were producing together, but before we could even get started or take a breath, he quickly told me a fascinating and at that time confidential story that was very interesting.
So what happens is when a virus gets into a pulmonary macrophage, the endosomes have these things called toll receptors, and toll receptors 7 and 8 bind to single-stranded RNA. And then what happens after that is the toll receptors are connected to the MYD88 and BTK signaling pathway and goes right through there to create the cytokine storm that gets patients into such trouble with ARDS. And so by inhibiting that pathway, you shut down the excessive inflammatory signaling that results in cytokine storm ARDS. And so I've now, not in my community, but I've worked with my network, and we've treated about 25 patients with ARDS and COVID. We've treated them with acalabrutinib, and it's impressive. They get better quickly, including patients who are intubated and so forth. So it's legit, and we should have it published. This has been a sort of tortuous story getting it published, but we should have it out next week.
Which journal?
Science Immunology.
Wow.
Yeah.
So can we talk about it? What we could do, if you want, I mean, it's totally up to you. We created about a month or two ago a new podcast. So if you want, I mean, we could hold it until you publish, if you would be up for that. Would you want to do that?
Yeah, I mean, as long as you can agree that we don't release anything until this is in print, like it's, you know, consider it embargoed, that would be fine.
So let me ask you now, are you in any, I know there's a big phase 3 trial with acalabrutinib. Are you involved with that at all?
Yeah. So what we're working to publish is the sort of pilot data that led to that, right? So
wow.
The FDA has been sort of unusually sticky on this, and we've had some difficulty. So initially, the thought was going to be that we were just going to do a large phase 2 experience with this. And the FDA was like, no, we really want this in the form of a randomized, placebo-controlled phase 3 study. I know,
wow.
Right? And, oh, by the way, you know, acalabrutinib is very pH sensitive and they come in capsules. So how do you administer that to patients who are on the ventilator? And it is actually quite challenging because what you end up having to do is open these capsules with like scissors or something like that. You can't just tear them apart. Then you have to dissolve it in like Coca-Cola. And that allows you to sort of get the pH right, and then you could administer it through the NG tube.
Wow. So is this the way it's being done in the trial?
Yeah. So what happened is AstraZeneca is actually moving forward with two studies. One is a phase 2 study that's going to get a lot of pharmacokinetics, particularly amongst those patients who are intubated because they want to verify the drug's getting into the system. And then there's a randomized phase 3 that will occur after that. And I have yet to see the randomized phase 3 protocol because it's still undergoing drafting and revisions. But I would say it's been somewhat slow getting through the FDA because we started discussions with them, 6 weeks ago, which granted 6 weeks probably is still fast by FDA standards, but obviously the crisis of the moment, you might have hoped for a faster trajectory through the FDA.
So are patients actually going on the phase 2 right now?
So some of this was just done as off-label use, right? Wow. I mean, the drug is commercially available. And so a lot of the pilot data was used as sort of an off-label experience, much in the same way that tocilizumab has been used off-label. And quite frankly, even hydroxychloroquine has been used off-label, right? I mean, you can use approved therapies off-label, and that's the context in which those patients have been treated.
So these patients that you're reporting, where are they from and how did you sort of coordinate this?
So the project started with, backing up, the preliminary science is really quite well modeled in mice. So about 2 years ago, there was a publication out of a group in Tyler, Texas, University of Texas, in which they gave mice a lethal dose of influenza, another single-stranded RNA virus, right? And what that showed was that, these mice would get the characteristic ARDS that, to this day impacts patients with flu when they die of the flu. And, we know from histologic models and so forth in COVID that really the pathology is this sort of macrophage activation syndrome within the lungs. And in those experiments with the mice, they gave the mice ibrutinib. And, it was just kind of a clear separation between those mice that were treated with ibrutinib versus those that didn't. Ibrutinib saved the mice. Now, it's a preclinical model, but it's, pretty reasonably robust preclinical data. And the hypothesis is that the same is true in COVID, another single-stranded RNA virus. And so some scientists at NIH treated the first couple patients with acalabrutinib off-label and saw favorable responses. And at that point, AstraZeneca reached out to me as to whether or not we might be able to contribute patients to this off-label experience as well. And I worked with some of my colleagues in Colorado and New York, and we did just that. We treated a number of additional patients, and those are all now aggregated into a single manuscript that's awaiting publication.
And how many patients were there?
19.
Any that you personally saw the patients?
No, because we talked about the other day, I really have very few cases here in my own community. So not myself, but I, stayed in pretty close communication with the docs for treating them.
And how many of these people were on ventilators at that time?
So in the manuscript, there are 11 patients who started therapy not on the ventilator, and there are 8 patients who were on the ventilator at the start of therapy.
What happened to those 8?
So it was a little bit of a mix. What you can see in the paper that's kind of a really neat figure is that shortly after starting the drug, the PaO2 to FiO2 ratio begins to improve. Now, the PaO2 to FiO2 ratio is essentially how well are you saturating on what level of oxygen support. So if you're saturating 100% on room air, which is 0.21, right, 100 divided by 0.2, you should have a number around 500. On the other hand, if you're saturating 90% on 100% FiO2, on a ventilator, you would have a number of like 0.9, right? And so that range between 500 down to, 90 sort of demarcates how well somebody's gas exchange is working. And what you can see pretty quickly in a lot of cases is that after starting the drug, that PaO2 to FiO2 ratio starts improving. And sort of at the exact same time, the C-reactive protein, which is an interleukin-6-driven reaction, starts falling. So about 48 hours after starting the drug, you see really marked drops in the C-reactive protein. And so you get markers of decreased inflammation, markers of increased oxygenation, sort of moving their statistically significant inverse correlation, if you will, that as you decrease the inflammation, you improve the oxygenation. So amongst those patients who started therapy on the vent, it was a little bit of a mixed bag of patients because there was one additional location I should mention was added in, and that was in New Jersey, and that was not our group. I wasn't affiliated with them. Amongst the patients that started relatively early after getting on the vent, actually all of those patients improved. There were some patients from the New Jersey location in which patients had been on the ventilator for 2 to 3 weeks before they started the therapy. And I think in those cases, you know, there's a lot of superseding problems that transpire when somebody's been on the ventilator for a long time. So, you know, the vent becomes kind of its own illness. And I think that some of those patients couldn't be well salvaged. So there were some deaths that occurred, but amongst the patients who started early, they all did quite well.
So I only have about like 3,500 questions, but let me pick a few of them. So you were talking about the flu. So do you see kind of the same cytokine release with flu, the same immune response with influenza?
Well, influenza is also an RNA virus, and the pathophysiology, you know, most people get through flu and do fine, right? But there are flu deaths every year. And in many cases, that's through an ARDS type picture. And so the hypothesis, the speculation is that that's really the same mechanism of physiology.
In terms of acalabrutinib and ibrutinib, any reason either based on data or theory why one would be better, why acala might be better than ibrutinib?
Well, in theory, right, there could be. I think it depends to some degree about which cellular compartment is more abnormal. And to clarify what I mean by that is we know that ibrutinib inhibits ITK, which is in the T-cell receptor signaling pathway, much the same way that BTK is in the B-cell receptor pathway. And in theory, if you inhibit either B-cell or T-cell response, there's some risk there that you may reduce the adaptive immune response. Conversely, you have a hyperactive sort of innate immune system, which is the macrophage compartment. And we're treating these patients for 10 days because we don't want to impair the ability of the adaptive immune response to control the virus. And so there would be some risk, of course, that individuals could have delayed clearance of the virus and so forth. But what we believe is that the macrophage, sort of this macrophage activation syndrome, is the dominant pathophysiology. And if we can suppress that enough to get the patient out of respiratory distress, the adaptive immune response will catch up.
So I know ibrutinib is approved for graft versus host disease. Can you kind of talk about the mechanisms involved with that and what the immune changes are that occur when you give BTK inhibitors?
Right. So ibrutinib, for the exact same reasons we just indicated previously, does inhibit ITK as well as BTK. And so I haven't studied the biology as closely in the graft versus host disease model, but the thought being that both B cells and T cells do contribute to some of the chronic graft versus host disease, and that that's the suppressive effect of ibrutinib. And so maybe conversely, acalabrutinib might not work as well in graft versus host because it's really the T cell component there that's more active. And as you know, actually in just this week's New England Journal, we also saw data on ruxolitinib in chronic graft versus host disease, where again, sort of suppressing this inflammatory hyperreactivity through tyrosine kinase inhibition.
And we are seeing trials looking at JAK inhibitors. What specifically is the mechanism there as it relates to COVID?
Well, there too, the hypothesis, of course, is that you have this immune hyperreactivity, and many of the inflammatory cytokines signal through the JAK-STAT signaling pathway. And so there, you're not so much blunting the production of these inflammatory cytokines, but you're blunting the reaction to them, right? So as these inflammatory cytokines sit on the T cells and so forth, that you would be inhibiting the outside-in signaling of those.
And this 10-day course of acalabrutinib, it's twice a day?
Yes.
What about the patients in your paper who were not on ventilators?
So those patients, by and large, did really quite well. There was one patient who passed away, and that was a patient who was on BiPAP and ended up with some barotrauma, had sort of a pneumothorax, pneumomediastinum, and then ended up succumbing to complications of that. So it wasn't so much the virus per se in that individual's case, but it was the consequences of barotrauma.
Now, these patients who weren't on vents, they were in the hospital?
All of them, yes. All of them, and they were all quite sick. You know, oftentimes either high-flow nasal cannula or BiPAP or, you know, some form of, there were only one or two patients where the oxygen requirement was relatively low. Most of these patients really had a very high oxygen requirement.
And other than that patient with a pneumothorax, how did the rest of them do?
They all did great. So, you know, look, it's early data. It's hypothesis generating. I don't want to conclude that this is now a standard of care or anything along those lines. This is a preclinical model that had been established in mice and that was extrapolated to the current situation. And I think we have pilot data that would support further investigation. But I think moving forward, you know, this should primarily be done within the context of clinical trials. And those are getting up and running currently.
What about patients who aren't hospitalized but have symptoms, you know, shortness of breath, cough, et cetera? Has this strategy been used on them?
No, it hasn't. And, you know, I think that we're kind of reserving this right now for those patients with the highest acuity where we think we can have a more clear benefit to risk ratio. You know, acalabrutinib's FDA approved for chronic use amongst patients with CLL. It has a very clean safety profile, but it's not without risk. I mean, every drug has risk. And so we would anticipate that a 10-day course shouldn't be associated with undue risk. But, you know, we also are respectful that patients with COVID appear to have coagulopathy issues. And that's, you know, one of the drug class issues is potentially some anticoagulant activity of the drug. You know, arrhythmias are thought to be a risk amongst patients with COVID. And so, you know, we're trying to be sensitive to it. So I think at least currently, until we have more validated information, I would probably reserve this for inpatients, ideally on a clinical trial.
So, you know, I was kind of surprised when I heard about BTK and for that matter, JAK inhibitors being used in this situation. I mean, to my simple mind, I kind of was thinking a little bit about cytokine storm that you see with CAR T therapy. And I don't know whether this is fundamentally different or not, but I never heard about those agents there. What is the difference? We know that what happens with, say, CAR T cytokine release as opposed to COVID.
Yeah. So, you know, there's actually some pretty compelling data that the co-administration of BTK inhibitors with CAR T is a very interesting strategy moving forward. And when I first heard about that, it seemed to me like maybe you're just taking one effective drug and adding it to another effective drug, and it didn't seem all that interesting. But actually, there's some pretty remarkable science that goes on, which is perhaps best illustrated amongst patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. In CLL, you have a group of T cells that are really lethargic. You know, they don't respond to stimuli. They don't, you know, that's part of the immune compromise in CLL is this really lethargic T cell compartment and sort of pseudo energy, if you will. If you treat patients with a BTK inhibitor, those T cells are actually easier to collect, easier to expand. And then when they are administered, you see actually a reduction in the cytokine release syndrome. It appears to actually maybe make it safer. And so those trials have begun to be reported, and some of the development strategies for CAR T, possibly in CLL, may actually be in co-administration with BTK inhibitors for that very reason.
Fascinating. What data do we have right now on this issue? There was a paper just of a few patients. I think we talked about it the other night in the webinar by Steve Treon at Dana-Farber looking at Waldenstrom's patients with COVID. I think there were like six patients. Any comment on that or any other data sets you've seen looking at this question?
Yeah, so there have been two data sets. The one you reference by Steve Treon, in which I think your numbers are exactly right. It was six or seven patients, right in that number. And it was sort of a retrospective analysis of patients with Waldenstrom's who then developed COVID and, you know, characterized their outcome. One particular patient in that study, and that was reported in Blood, I believe, had been on ibrutinib, had their ibrutinib discontinued, deteriorated quite quickly following the elimination of ibrutinib, became ventilated, and then they subsequently gave the patient ibrutinib on the ventilator and the patient recovered. Now, anecdotal, right? I mean, similarly to ours is anecdotal. We just have maybe a larger number of anecdotes. There was a second group in New York that reported on a approximately similar number of patients with CLL treated with BTK inhibitors. And this was also a retrospective analysis. And, you know, it appeared that maybe those patients with CLL treated with ibrutinib had less acute outcomes with COVID. But all the caveats of retrospective small number experiences.
Wow. I'm just trying to imagine you know, the reaction to this paper, as you say, it is approved. You know, you imagine people who have COVID or they have patients with COVID, oncologists who know about this. I mean, I don't know. I think it would be pretty tempting to try it. What do you think?
You know, I think that this is a unique environment that we find ourselves in which we have, you know, a critical illness against which we really don't have particularly effective therapies. And, you know, I don't think we're going to be through COVID until we have, you know, abundant, accurate testing. We have an effective antiviral, some sort of anti-inflammatory, and ultimately a vaccine. You know, so could this play the role of an anti-inflammatory? I think it could. You know, acalabrutinib is not inexpensive. It's, you know, $15,000+ for a month of therapy. Now, if you could break a bottle apart into three patients, you know, maybe it starts to become more cost effective. But there's really so many unknowns in this right now that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a 10-day course.
Yeah. No, I understand. And, you know, so theoretically, one bottle, you know, it may compare to a dose of tocilizumab in that way, right? Because you could potentially treat three patients out of one bottle. And, you know, there are multiple BTK inhibitors. There's ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, and I think it would be great for us to get more information about the efficacy in this.
Wow. Amazing.
Obviously, it's such a challenging time, right? Because you want to do what's right, and I don't want to advocate for things that aren't evidence-based. After having been through this experience, I would say that I, you know, sort of have a scientific hypothesis and maybe even a personal conviction. But, you know, how many times have those been proven wrong? You know, not necessarily for myself, but, you know, that's just the way science works, right? So it's early, it's encouraging, and I'm excited, but I don't want to overstate what this is. For myself, though, if I'm on BiPAP or something like that, I would. The mechanism makes sense, and our experience to date follows the preclinical model. So I would be doing that for myself, but I don't know that I could necessarily, you know, wholeheartedly recommend that for the field.
You said something about a fellowship project. What was that?
So when I was at Stanford, I started a project on B cell receptor signal inhibition at that time with a SYK inhibitor, SYK. And SYK is one molecule to the left of BTK in the signaling cascade. And we saw evidence of efficacy. That particular drug had liabilities that kept us from really taking it forward. But Richard Miller, who was the CMO of Pharmacyclics at the time, was one of our guest attendings. And so he saw our patients having responses to fostamatinib. And so I helped him co-write the first in human study of PCI32765, which became ibrutinib. And then we were in the first in human study. If you actually look at that paper, it's mostly US oncology authors on that. So that paper grew out of my fellowship project.
Wow. So what's it been like? What was it like when you started to see what was going on?
You know, one of the funny things when we started that study was we only had 28-day safety information from monkeys. And so the original study was written where patients got it for 28 days, then they had 7 days off, then they started it for 28 days again. And, you know, it's been well documented since that time that when you start somebody on ibrutinib, they get this very rapid lymphocytosis. And then the reverse is also true, that when you stop the drug, it plummets. And in fact, patients' lymph nodes will swell up when you stop the drug and can be symptomatically painful. So for the first 6 months of the study, we had patients doing this, you know, all along. And it was a little bit harder to identify whether or not patients were benefiting or whether we are just moving things around, right? I mean, if you're just moving them from the lymph nodes to the blood and back to the lymph nodes into the blood, you couldn't necessarily see the trend line emerge. We had seen that similar phenomena with fostamatinib. So when the very first patient got treated with ibrutinib, at that point, Ahmed Hamdi was the CMO of Pharmacyclics. And so I called him ahead of time. I said, you know, we're going to expect to see the lymphocyte count go up and the lymph nodes come down. And sure enough, you know, day two or whatever it was, the patient came back and the lymphocyte count had tripled. And of course, he was very uncertain as to whether. So we got sort of a stat CT scan on that patient to verify that the lymph nodes were in fact smaller. And they were. So, you know, it fit our prior experience with other B cell receptor inhibitors. And so we had treated a handful of CLL patients, and then we had an advisory board, and I presented our CLL patients to John Bird and Susan O'Brien and Steve Coutre. And those guys, I think, were able to appreciate that moving things out of the lymph node, out of the bone marrow, would be beneficial, you know, whereas I was still kind of stuck in the, I don't know if I'm helping somebody just moving it around. They knew the biology much better than I did at that point, knew that it was going to be a drug. And so they jumped on board at that point very quickly. And we modified the protocol to have it continuous. Then you could see the nice downsloping lymphocyte count, the lymph node staying down. So, you know, it became clear, although it wasn't clear to me in the first 6 months, that we were helping patients.
And how long ago was it that that first patient got a BTK inhibitor?
It would have been the start of 2009. We reported the very first presentation in a poster at ASH in December of 2009. So I think we were doing that probably in the summer of 2009.
Yep. So here it is a little bit more than 10 years later, yeah. And you're looking at trials in COVID.
Isn't that crazy? You know, the thing is, I think that once we have these, look, we have drugs that interfere with critical signaling pathways, and it would be silly to think that those critical signaling pathways are only important in leukemia or lymphoma, right? I mean, it's inflammation in general. So which inflammatory conditions? So when ibrutinib was stuck on a shelf before we put it into patients, their preclinical modeling was all about rheumatoid arthritis. So we were looking at mouse foot pad, you know, experiments, you know, where you could inject collagen and they would get this inflammatory reaction. But if you give them a BTK inhibitor, they were a lot better. I have a patient who I just saw yesterday who had been on a study of a BTK inhibitor, but also has rheumatoid arthritis, and it really controlled her rheumatoid arthritis quite well. She had to come off the drug because she actually had disease progression, and her rheumatoid arthritis has been extremely difficult to control since coming off therapy. So it's going to be rheumatoid arthritis and who knows what other inflammatory conditions.
Well, if this were a movie, I'd be really looking forward to the next part.
Oh, God, I don't know what it's going to be, right? So, but yeah, no doubt.
So thanks a lot for chatting with me today, Joe.
You bet, Neil. Take care.
That's it for this issue of Oncology Today. Check out the playback of our recent webinar with Jeff, Dr. Anthony Mato from Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, and Dr. Matt Davids of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston at researchtopractice.com/CLL-COVID-19. Be safe and stay well. See you next time.